This talk will be has really two parts to it. It's an application of Jordan algebras to quantum mechanics. That's the first part. And that will be a follow-up to the talk by John Bias. One of the points that he didn't mention in his talk was how you introduce time dependence. So that will be the principal new feature here. And then the other application is to five-dimensional supergravity theories. And part of the motivation for that is, of course, that it gets in aspects to do with the exceptional Jordan algebra, which are 3x3 matrices over the Octonians. So we get the Octonians in that particular context. And one of the things that I'm going to be needing for the supergravity part, and in fact, to some extent, also for the Jordan algebra, but for the Jordan formulation of quantum mechanics, are the cones associated to Jordan algebra. So I have a little interlude here, which I will elaborate a little bit on the geometry of these cones, because that will be needed directly in the supergravity case. In fact, John Byers already mentioned them in his talk on the applications to quantum mechanics. So as we learned from John Byers's talk, you associate observables with elements of a formally real, otherwise known as Euclidean Jordan algebra, and it has to have an identity matrix. And then you deduce various properties of that. So the first point that's important is that the Jordan identity, which defines Jordan algebras, is actually equivalent to power associativity. So although the algebra itself is non-associative, any particular member element can be multiplied by itself any number of times, and the order in which you do the multiplications isn't relevant. So in particular, you can define exponentiation. So that's essentially a map that takes you from any element to a positive element. So you can view the Jordan algebra, forget the algebra part, as just some vector space, then you're simply taking some general vector to one in some cone. So some positive elements of J. So that's the positive convex cone of the algebra by exponential map. Then another point that John mentioned is that every Jordan algebra can be expressed as a direct sum of simple Jordan algebras. So that makes life very simple. And if you have a simple Jordan algebra with identity E0, then you can choose a basis E0 and then some other elements in the basis, call them EI. And then the structure constants of the algebra, the multiplication, can be written out. Obviously, the first two, of course, is just definition of identity element. And then the last one gives you, EI with EJ, you get back E0 or another E, and then you get the tensors, delta IJ, TI, JK. So, the fact that it's delta ij in here, because you can always rescale to get it to be plus ones and minus ones. And the fact that it's always plus one and never a minus one, that's connected to the fact that it's a Euclidean. That's a formally real thing. So that's where the Euclidean terminology comes from, that this has to be delta ij. And then these reduced structure constants, as I'll call them later, that you can, that by without loss of generality, you can take those to be totally symmetric on IJK. And the automorphism group of the algebra is essentially the subgroup of linear transformations that leaves these things here as invariant tensors. So clearly here we have to have a subgroup of SON, and that would be broken down to some smaller group if you have some TIJK. So the automorphism group generally is some subgroup of SON. Good. Just make sure I didn't go two. That's right. Good. So the next point is that so viewing it as a just a Euclidean space, and then the cone is just simply a subspace. In that you can define the characteristic function. So any cone, basically, you can define a characteristic function. This is what it is for the cone of Jordan algebra. So it's omega to the minus one, and then you integrate over the cone, e to the minus some inner product. In this case, it's of course the trace, and then integrate over y over the cone. And x here is just, I'm expanding it on basis, so this basis EI. So n plus one components there, yeah. And from that definition, it follows that if you have some linear transformation that takes x to ax, with it's in the cone, so ax is another element in the cone, that's an automorphism, because you could take a transformation where it goes outside the cone. That would not be an automorphism. So as long as you have a linear transformation that takes you from one vector to another one in the cone, then you have this transformation here under automorphisms. And so that tells you, because the cone will always include one automorphism, will always be scaling. You can always simply scale it up and down by definition of a cone. So that means immediately that this function omega has to be homogeneous of degree n plus one. In fact, it's always omega squared is always a polynomial probably under conditions, particular conditions, I can't remember what they are. But anyway, for the cone associated with the Jordan algebra, it's always, omega squared is in fact always a power of a polynomial, generally a power of a polynomial of lower degree. And I'm calling it n, and that's called the norm of the Jordan algebra. And so this is some homogeneous polynomial degree nu, some natural numbers, 1, 2, 3, et cetera. And in fact, we can sort of classify the Jordan algebras by according to their degree. That's a useful way of classifying them. And let me just note here, of course, that omega is, if you have a general automorphism of the cone, if you put delta A is equal to one, then the omega is invariant under that. And therefore, so is norm function. So the invariance group of this norm is in fact this reduced structure group. And the reduction here simply means that we don't consider the scaling. So we just restrict to det A equals one. And that structure group generally will be larger than the automorphism group because it doesn't fix the identity element. Ah, yes, of course. So here we go to the classification, which was John Bias gave you during his talk. So here you can just classify them by degree. So you have the real numbers. And then you have, for degree two, the Jordan algebra is always associated in that with a quadratic function. The norm is quadratic. Now, in this case, in fact, these reduced structure constants to zero. And that means the automorphism group is SON. And then if you look at the norm, it's a quadratic function. It has to be, and that's the curious thing. The quadratic function always has Lorentzian, is always Lorentzian signature for these nu equals two cases. When the algebra is Euclidean, when the Jordan algebra is Euclidean. So in this case, you see that the structure group is, which is the invariance group with this norm, is just the Lorentz group, SO1 over 9, SO1n, and that of course contains this automorphism group, SOM. And if you view Q, so in this particular case, you can view this quadratic norm, you can view it as an alternative metric. We started with Euclidean metric, but now you could view this as an alternative metric. And in that interpretation, this cone is actually the positive light cone in Minkowski space. Okay, now then we move on to the degree three case. And then we have essentially 3x3 Hermitian matrices. And well, in fact, whether it's three or higher, you always have n x n Hermitian matrices. Let's get the higher ones out of the way first. Then you can, there's 3x3 Hermitian matrices, n x n Hermitian matrices over the reals, complex, or quaternions. And the special feature about three is that you can also do it over the octonions, because in that case, but only in that case, can you define the notion of a determinant? So the norm for these 3x3 ones is just the determinant of the matrix. And so the structure group is then just the invariance group of that determinant, which is actually SL3K for the reals, complex, and quaternions. And of course, the way you define SL3 over the quaternions is in exact analogy to the way you define it over the SL2. Over the quaternions that I discussed in the last talk that I gave. And I suppose it must be the case that SL3 over the octonions or this particular group, E6 minus 26, it must be, presumably can be viewed as SL3 over the Octonians in a similar way. But I don't think anybody's ever tried to spell that out. By the way, the minus 26 here refers to that number in there gives you the number of non-compact minus compact dimensions, directions. So the maximally non-compact would be minus 133, and the maximally compact is minus 133, and the maximally non-compact is in fact 6. So it goes from the rank plus the rank to minus the dimension.
I think you mean minus 78, so, but.
Oh, 78. No, I'm thinking E7. Yes, 78. That's correct. Yes, yes. okay, so that's the classification that we had from John, expressed in a slightly different way. And the E6 minus 26, that will be coming up shortly, certainly in the supergravity case. I see I've done things slightly out of order here because I already introduced a trace when I was defining the norm. And now I'm introducing a trace. So, well, okay. I realize a little bit of circularity there. So in fact, they're connected, of course. But you can introduce a trace form with the property that the trace of the unit identity element is this degree, nu, and the trace of the rest is 0. And it's a relation to the matrix trace. So for nu equals 2, then you have a realization by generalized Pauli matrices. And then, so that's the realization here. And then you have to take the Jordan product to be a factor. It has to be actually n over 4 times the anticommutator. And then the trace is just the matrix trace. And then for nu equals 3 as well, it's just the trace of the 3x3 matrices. And the Jordan product is then half the anticommutator. Of course, that has to be taken with a little bit of grain of salt for the exceptional case, because the exceptional Jordan algebra, they're not really matrices because they're Octonians and they're non-associative. So not all identities for Hermitian matrices will be satisfied, but you have to go to, I think, some degree 7 or 8 to get something that's not satisfied by the exceptional algebra, but is for everything else. Okay, so then we come to the states. To understand the states, you need to understand the primitive idempotents of the algebra. So P squared is P is an idempotent, basically a projector, and you want is primitive if trace P is 1. And any two of these primitive idempotents, any two idempotents are orthogonal if the Jordan product of them is equal to 0. And the point is that there are at most new mutually orthogonal primitive idempotents. That doesn't mean that there are two unique ones or n new unique ones, but you can't find more than that number of them. And if you have some maximal set of that kind, then you've got a decomposition of the unity. So E0 can be written as P1, P nu. So to take an example, if you take the degree 2 Jordan algebras, then you can take, for example, P plus, you have two of them, call them plus and minus, P plus, P minus. So this one here, that has these properties. They are primitive idempotents, and in fact, they are orthogonal. But you can see, obviously, here, what's special about 1? I get about 2, 3, or any other element in there. I get a whole different set of 2 primitive idempotents. But if you try to add a third one, you can never get 3 primitive idempotents. And that's why essentially these are spin systems. I mean, these things, you've got 2 eigenvalues all the time, plus or minus 1. So then when we come to nu equals 3, so for 3x3 matrix realization, then this is one obvious realization. And you can see now why, for example, when you take the Jordan product, you don't have to take the trace to get 0, just the product itself, because here you're basically taking the anticommutator of this with this, well, that would be 0. And then this was this 0, so you see you get 0 here. Okay, now the point about those primitive idempotents is that you can write any observable. So this is a theorem, I think it's due to Jordan in the paper Jordan, von Neumann, and Wigner, that if you have any observable, it can be decomposed into sum of eigenpotents, and with the coefficients represent the, so written this way, and the point is there's an interpretation is that the coefficients represent the eigenvalues of the of that observable. And the eigenpotents here represent then the eigenstates. And so that's a theorem about Jordan algebras. And so you can see that there are some, in some sense, two states. If you have nu equals two, then you have kind of two state system. And that's why the Jordan algebras of degree two is called spin systems. In the case of the 3x3 case, of course, it's you have three states. And of course, these eigenstates are unique only if the eigenvalues are distinct. So if you have two similar eigenvalues, then you can have rotations of one, and you're gonna have, it's not unique anymore. That's more or less as you'd expect. Anyway, the point here is that the pure states are represented by these primitive eigenpotents, and there's a kind of correspondence to the usual eigenvalues and eigenstates of the standard formulation. But then it's useful to go look at the mixed states. So if you have a general mixed state, then that will be any elements in the cone associated with the Jordan algebra. But it has to have trace one. So that's the probability one condition. And that state will be pure then if rho squared is equal to rho. And so this is also mentioned by John Byers, that so these are the these are extremal points. They're on points on the boundary, extremal points on the boundary of this cone. And the expectation value of the observable in the state rho is, as usual, just is the trace of A of rho. So that's very similar to the density matrix of formulation of quantum mechanics, except for one point, and that was also discussed by John Byers, but there's one point of difference, because if you ask about the time dependence, then there's no obvious analog of the Heisenberg equation of motion for the density matrix. So this is the standard formula, rho dot is minus I H over rho, rho is the density matrix. And so you introduce a Hamiltonian, you write this down. The problem is that this is not defined for a Jordan algebra. For an abstract Jordan algebra, that's simply not defined. So what do you do? Now, it's interesting to point out here, interesting point here is that it's often said that that quantum mechanics needs complex numbers. But actually, as this Jordan formulation point really shows you, that's not true as long as you're restricted to, as long as you stay with just the formalism of observables and states. The only time that you actually need to introduce complex numbers is when you discuss time evolution. So really, the I coming in quantum mechanics that one has to put in all the time is really comes in because of time evolution. And one of the kind of virtues, I think, of the Jordan formulation is that it makes that point clear. It's, you can do everything without introducing an I, we just did it. But when you come to the formulation of the time dependence, well, it seems that we're going to need an I if we want to do it in the usual way. We can't do it in that usual way, so what do you do? Well, the point is that if you want the time evolution to take a pure state into another pure state, and normally, of course, you do want that because you want preservation of unitarity, et cetera. And the first time I got interested in this actually was in around 85 or thereabouts, because Hawking had suggested that maybe you should have a time evolution that does not take pure states into another pure state. So I tried to see whether or not you could understand how that might be natural in the context of Jordan algebras. But in any case, if you wanted to take a pure state in another pure state, then essentially you needed some operation which is a derivation of the algebra. Derivation just means that you satisfy the Leibniz rule. And the reason you need that is because the time derivative satisfies the Leibniz rule. And so if you're trying to preserve a relation like rho squared is equal to rho, then Leibniz rule on the left-hand side means a Leibniz rule on the right-hand side. And all derivations of a Jordan algebra actually can be generated by two elements. You have to pick two elements. And then if you define left multiplication by element X as LX, then derivation, all derivations can be represented as commutators of these left multiplications with different elements. So if you act that, so all derivations can be written this way. So if you act that on rho, then you get, here we get it. We first of all multiply by Y and then by X. Then we do that the other way around. And you can rewrite it like this, because remember the Jordan product is commutative. And you see here that that is the associator of rho with X and Y. So I can write that relation, therefore, as rho dot is X rho Y. Notice that it's antisymmetric in the first and third. But it's not totally antisymmetric. And in fact, I only discovered relatively recently that this was actually proposed in Nambu's paper on his work on generalized, well, what we now call Nambu mechanics. Essentially, he wanted to generalize the idea of a Poisson bracket. So instead of a Poisson bracket of two elements, he has a kind of Poisson type bracket of three elements or more, but he focused mostly on three. And so he developed a little bit the classical mechanics of this Nambu mechanics. And when he came, and there are particular classical examples he gives. They all involve angular momentum, by the way, which I think is perhaps not surprising. But at any rate, then he addressed the question, well, how do I quantize? So when I know how to go from a Poisson bracket to, I know how to quantize that. We just turn that into I times a commutator. But what do you do if you have one of these Nambu brackets? And he considered various possibilities, none of which was entirely satisfactory. But one of the ones he suggested was that, in fact, the Jordan algebra is, that the Jordan formulation is really the quantization of Nambu mechanics. Now, actually, this particular problem is, it's been a lot discussed in recent years. And, you know, I don't know exactly, the status is still a little bit unclear exactly how you should, whether or not this really should have anything, have any relation to Nambu brackets. But in any case, that's how it first came up. Notice that of course, taking t goes to minus t now really means flipping x and y. Now, let's see if you, of course, in the case where you can realize the Jordan algebra as halved, in terms of the anti-commutator of matrices, which you can do in all cases, except, of course, the exceptional Jordan algebra. So in all the other cases, you can, in fact, write it in terms of a matrix formulation. So you have a matrix now, but now you're picking out two elements, so two elements, basically two kind of Hamiltonians. And you write the time dependence this way. This avoids putting in an I. So you see, you can still write it down without putting in an I. But if you do have an I, if you do have complex Hermitian matrices, complex numbers, then you can recover the Heisenberg equation by making this identification of, oops, that's Hamiltonian equal to itself, of course. H is I over 4 times the commutator. So that's where the I gets in again. And a simple example, by the way, with lambda equals 0, is you just take the 2 by 2, take the J to be the algebra of 2 by 2 Hermitian matrices. The basis is 1 and the sigma matrix Pauli matrices. And you choose x, y to be sigma x, sigma y, and then you get rho dot is this. And that's just this, with h is the Hamiltonian for a spin-half particle in a uniform magnetic field. So that's a simple example of this application of Jordan. So anyway, that's all I wanted to say about the Jordan formulation of quantum mechanics, based most of it this issue of how you deal with time dependence. Okay, let's move on now to, I want to discuss some more things about these cones associated with Jordan algebras. Well, if you focus on this expression here, basically what I want to do is look at the elements in the dual cone, dual vector space. So consider this particular one here. X star is new to the minus one. I take the derivative of logarithm of the norm. Well, if you just use the homogeneity of the norm, you see that that satisfies xi, x star I. So they're kind of paired elements in the cone and the dual cone. Differentiating, in fact, and using this relation here, you find that xi is simply related to the x by a metric on space here, which is in fact a positive definite metric on the cone, given by this expression here. It's positive, so if this is a positive element, this is a positive element too. So the cone is a self-dual cone. Every vector in the cone has a dual vector also in the cone, and you map one vector to another vector in the cone, and there's only one point in the cone where it just maps to itself. And that's this base point, which is represented by the identity element. And that's its own dual, because if hij is delta ij, then the only x, so the only way you're going to get in this metric here, the only time that that is equal to delta ij is that this element here is equal to E0. And for example, you can see that for the nu equals two case, because if that's equal zero, then it's just one actually, because of course I take the yes, it's a constant. Oh, never mind. Let me pass over that one. Confusing myself. Anyway, that's the case. The other point about this is that if you ask what the curvature of the cone is, so we've introduced here. So in principle, we started with this Euclidean metric. Now we've introduced this positive definite metric on the cone. And you can ask, well, what's its curvature? And its curvature is in fact given by the associator of the Jordan algebra. So if I take the, in that basis, so if I it's actually a cone, I really only need to look at the curvature at one point, because we have the transitive action of this structure group on the cone. You basically go, if you think of the light cone, you basically have the Lorentz group taking you along the hyperboloids, and then you go up the cone with just the scale. So, and that's the case with all the Jordan algebras. So essentially you have some symmetric homogeneous space, so you can just pick one number, one point. And so if you pick the base point, then in fact, you get the curvature of the cone at that point. So it's given by E chi EJ. So it has to be antisymmetric in EI and EJ. That's the antisymmetry of these two elements here. So that's the curvature. Now I'm going to use that particular equation just in the next transparency. So I just put an asterisk on there so you can remember it. So the point is that, as I was sort of saying just a moment ago, is the cone is foliated by scaled copies of this symmetric space, the structure group over the automorphism group. Because the structure group is this group of automorphisms of the norm, stability. So that's, and if you think of the cone in the just the light cone in just to, you know, to visualize it, the light cone in Minkowski space, then you have these hyperboloids. And if you just say fix the point at the bottom, that's simply the automorphism group. That's the stability group of those surfaces. It's just the automorphism group of the algebra. And so the Lorentz group takes you everywhere, and then the rotation group is just the symmetry group around a particular point. And that's just a generalization of that, generalizes to all of these other Jordan algebras. So in the case of nu equals two, that is precisely the case. So that is precisely the light cone case. And then you have a maximally symmetric space. In the case of nu equals three, and let's take the case of H3 over the octonions, because that's the octonionic case, the one we're going to be interested in. And in that case, in fact, the the geometry of this cone is that the geometry of the of in a surface, hypersurface in that cone, is just this coset space E6 minus 26 over F4. So F4 is the maximally compact subgroup of this particular non-compact version of E6. And you recall from that previous expression for the curvature tensor, so that if you so at the base point E0, the curvature tensor takes this form. And before I might just remind myself, the point here was that, I'm trying to remember where this I was. Oh, I think that I had that formula previously when we worked out. If I just go back a little bit here, I think it was, I thought I had the formula. I thought I prepared that by that formula. So if you you can see, for example, if I just come back here, you see EI, EJ, if I just take another E with this, what I'm going to get is a product, something that's quadratic in the T. So I'll basically delta, delta, and then it's something that's quadratic in the T, because E0 is orthogonal to K. So you get this structure, which is the standard Riemann curvature tensor for a symmetric space. So now let's apply that. The next step is to apply that to these supergravity theories in five dimensions. So if I emit the fermions, then the supersymmetry multiplets are the graviton multiplet. Well, there are three in principle. There's the graviton multiplet. There's a Maxwell. We've got one of those. The Maxwell multiplets, where we have n of those. There are also some possible hypermultiplets, but they won't play a role in what I want to say here. In principle, they could play a role later. For example, if you ask how would you get this structure from 11 dimensions by compactification, I'll mention that later. Then you would also get some hypermultiplets.
Sorry to disturb you. I had a question.
Yeah, go ahead. Oh, sorry. I don't have a notice here where I can see if somebody's putting questions in the chat or something. But so go ahead. Yeah.
The space M that you defined in the previous slide, does that have any connection with how you defined time a few slides back?
No, I don't think so. No. Mm-hmm. This is definitely parts one and part two, and I put an interlude between them to emphasize the fact that there's no obvious, no immediate connection, of course.
Because in Kohn's non-commutative geometry, he invoked this so-called Tomita Takasaki theory to define a time parameter, which looked very similar to how you are doing this M through this. Are these like outer or?
Well, you could take, for example, this algebra of, 3x3 algebra of the Octonians. I mean, you could take that as your Jordan algebra, and then all your elements, you could interpret them as observables.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can ask, what are the pure states in that and so on? And then you could ask, then the geometry of the cone could become relevant to some quantum mechanical question that you're going to consider. However, as I was stressing, you can set up all of that issue about the observables and the observables, and the states, and whether they're pure states, et cetera. That's all independent of the time variation. So in some sense, you could use all of this in the context of the 3x3 quantum mechanics of this particular Jordan algebra, which of course, has been discussed, I think, by Murat Ganayden and collaborators, Gosset and so on in the past. And I'm sure that actually this actually does come into their discussion. I didn't go back to look at their paper. Actually, a very long time ago since I looked at that, but I imagine that it is relevant to that. But not to, as far as I'm aware, you know, time dependence doesn't really enter into it. Anyway, you know, that's, you know, at some level, everything is connected to everything else. So the answer in principle must always be yes. If somebody says, is that connected to something else? The answer is always yes, because everything is connected to everything.
But
if we understood it well enough.
The way you define time, the way you define time is in some is unique to octonions, right? Because you use the associator. So you couldn't
in this case, of course, you cannot, you have to do it in terms of the Jordan algebras. And then you define it. I mean, you need two Hamiltonians, basically. I mean, you're never going to introduce a complex number, but you're going to need two Hamiltonians. And then you have to know, I don't know what that means, really. The interpretation of it is sort of problematic.
Okay, thank you.
So coming back to these supergravities, so you have these multiplets, there's some hypermultiplets which I ignore. If you combine them, then you see that I have now n plus one. I still have n of these scalars, but n plus one of these abelian one-form potentials. And the scalars, map the space-time to some n-dimensional target space. And essentially, once you know the target space, then you really know all of the interactions of the supergravity theory. And of course, how you work out what that is or what the possibilities for it are, essentially by demanding supersymmetry. And of course, in some cases, you'll discover that supersymmetry only allows very definite cases. In some cases, it provides just restrictions. So in any case, in this particular case, Lagrangian contains the following terms are the ones which you need to focus on. Because here you have a metric on the target space. So the scalar fields parameterize the target space, and there's a metric on it. And now you have these coefficients, kind of these kinetic terms for the vector fields. It's not really a metric because I runs from one to n, you know, has n plus one values, and it's a function of only n of them. So it's not really a metric, but we'll see how it's related. These two are closely related. In a moment, I'll explain how. And then you have some constants here which come in. And they really have to be constants because you can see this involves a kind of Chern-Simons term. It's A wedge F is, well, that's not gauge invariant. But if you integrate, then it's gauge invariant up to a total derivative. Provided that these Cij are constants. So they must be constants. And that's a crucial restriction, very strong restriction. So how does the convex cone get, how do we use that in this context? Well, so we're supposing you've got a space of Euclidean space, n plus one dimensions, choose Cartesian coordinates and just define this cubic homogeneous polynomial. You'll use those constants of the supergravity theory just to define this cubic function here. And then let's say phi A are going to be the coordinates on that hypersurface. Then if you can use that function n with phi, they become kind of curvilinear coordinates for this convex cone, alternatives to these Cartesian ones. And you can define the metric on that cone as d squared log n in the way I've been describing previously. Now, if you use that construction, then what happens is that you can interpret hij, that's the metric, target space metric, as the pullback to the hypersurface of this cone metric. So that's how this quantity is going to then appear in the supergravity theory, looking at the details. And then the other one, hij, is the restriction of that metric to the hypersurface of the cone metric. So one is the pullback, and this one is just the restriction. And then finally, the pullback of CIJK itself to that target space, that can be interpreted as a tensor on the target space, which is TIJ, symmetric tensor. But it's a particular symmetric tensor because it's expressed originally in terms of these constants. And that together with the supersymmetry, Gramsci's supersymmetry, gives you a crucial, basically gives you a differential equation to be satisfied by this tensor on the target space. And basically, if you can solve this equation, then you have a model. So all of the models are basically in one-to-one, you know, in correspondence with solution to this equation. You can actually solve it. In fact, you can show that the general solution is expressed in terms of the coefficients Cijk, just the reduced structure constant. So what would be the reduced structure constants if it's a Jordan algebra? Although, I mean, it's only in special cases that it is, in fact, related to Jordan algebra. So there are more than Jordan algebra cases, but the Jordan algebra cases are a special subset. So in particular, and if this constant is covariantly constant, so one way to solve the equation is simply by saying, well, let it be covariantly constant. If that's the case, then in fact, it's equal at the base point, those constants you get. So that tensor, if you simply evaluate it at the base point, that is the reduced structure constants of Jordan algebra. So the Jordan algebra really encodes the entire, all the interactions of the theory for this particular subclass of theories, where this is a covariantly constant tensor. And I should say, whether it's covariantly constant or otherwise, there is a integrability condition, which is this condition on the Riemann tensor. So the Riemann tensor always takes this form, but this tensor here, symmetric tensor, is not always covariantly constant. So there's a special subclass of theories with higher dimensions where you take that to be covariantly constant. And when you get that, then this target space is a symmetric space. So we're interested in symmetric spaces. One of the reasons we're interested in symmetric spaces is because we'd like to have a unified theory. We'd like to have a theory that relates this multiplet to this multiplet with a symmetry. And so if you have a symmetric space with a transitively acting symmetry group in which this is an irreducible representation, then in that sense, you get a unified theory. So that's really sort of the motivation for considering the requirement that you have a symmetric space. There is actually one other symmetric space you get in the other way, but I'm going to concentrate now on these Jordan cases. So there's, in particular, not only the Jordan algebra cases, I'm going to focus on the case when the Jordan algebra is this particular exceptional Jordan algebra, because that's what gets in the Octonians. And in fact, it gets in the most interesting cases as well. So if we take the Jordan algebra to be this particular case, then the particular symmetric space that you get is this E6 minus 26 over F4. And that determines all of the other interactions of the supergravity theory. And I should say also, of course, that this satisfies that kind of principle that I was using to motivate the ideas initially, that this E6 symmetry group acts irreducibly on these one-form potentials. They're in the 27 representation of this E6. I should say, by the way, that in five dimensions, these potentials, I mean, in four dimensions, generally speaking, you need to look at the potential, you need to look at the field strengths and their duals in order to get some representation of these non-compact symmetry groups. But in five dimensions, it's simply a symmetry of the action transforming these potentials irreducibly as 27 representation. Now, let me just make a remark here about the potential origin from 11 dimensions, because if you do a Calabi-Yau compactification from 11 dimensions down to five dimensions, then you get basically a supergravity theory of the kind that I was writing down at least some of the terms earlier. And if then if you ask, well, what are these coefficients Cijk in that context? They are simply the integral of the products of the wedge products of the harmonic 1-1 forms on the space. So in fact, you always have sort of n plus one of them, where n is just 1, 2, 3 or something. And there's always one, there's a special one, which is always the Kähler 2 form. So you always have the sort of general structure that I wrote down previously. But the question is, which particular n equals, which five-dimensional supergravity theories do you get by these Calabi-Cloud compactifications? Now, I think Murat Ganadian and Herman Sierra and I looked at this some years ago. We actually started looking by all these tables of all of these Betti numbers of Calabi-Yau manifolds, and you can try to see if you get the numbers right. But there was none at that time, there was none of them that really worked. So we came to the conclusion, it's unknown. So I think that's an interesting question. Hasn't really been studied much. Which ones do you get? I don't know. But it would be very nice, of course, if you could get this one here, because that would be then, in principle, that would be a way of going sort of directly from M theory to something which is directly involves this exceptional Jordan algebra. But that's speculative. Now I'm getting close to the end. The next step is you really want to go down to four dimensions. So let's just do a straightforward dimensional reduction from five dimensions. I mean, you could do something a bit more, you know, you could reduce on a cylinder. I mean, you could do various more complicated things, but let's just do the simple thing. You just straightforwardly dimensionally reduce. Well, what do you have now? Well, you have a space-time metric. You have n plus two abelian for one forms now, so you get an additional one. And now you have n plus one complex scalars. So basically, everything gets complexified. In fact, the scalar field target space is now, it's now the so-called Kircher half space or domain of positivity of the Jordan algebra, or whatever it's called, I think. Anyway, it's this quantity. It's essentially, yeah, it's the analog of an upper half plane. So in the case that we take the Jordan algebra, it's just the real numbers. This is the upper half plane. So it's a kind of generalization to Jordan algebras of the upper half plane. And that's, of course, holomorphically equivalent to, you know, there's an analog of the Poincaré disk, which is called a bounded symmetric domain. And there's a Kähler potential on it, which is this particular Kähler particular function here. So the norm that we had in five dimensions is used again here. And in fact, what you find this space is this particular target space here is this coset space. It's now, and it's now this Möbius group over a compact structure group. And this Möbius group is that, I think this comes, these are various names. Murat Ganadian, basically. So it has various other names. I don't think Möbius is a standard name, but what it is, if you want to know an idea what it is, if you look at the 2x2 Hermitian matrices, then that's always the conformal group. So for the octonions, it's just the conformal group in 10 dimensions. In fact, it's the conformal group in any of those cases. So you go from, it's essentially a generalization. If you think of it, it's going from the automorphisms, it's the rotation, the structure group is the Lorentz group, and then the Möbius group is the conformal group. So rotations, you know, Lorentz group, conformal group, that whole thing generalizes to arbitrary Jordan algebras, except we're calling it the Möbius. In any case, for the particular one of 3x3 octonionic matrices, it's a non-compact form of E7, E7 minus 25. And to conclude, and this is my last slide here, so what you get for the for this exceptional group is a target space, which is E7 minus 25 over E6 times U1. And that can be compared with the E77 over SU8 for N equals 8 supergravity. In fact, in both cases, you have 28 gauge fields, whose field strengths and their duals, that makes 54, transform as irreducibly under E7. But actually, they're slightly different E7s. So the E7 minus 25 and E7 7. So again, it's this kind of unified theory. I mean, even it's, of course, it's unified in N equals 8, but even for this N equals 2 theory. And but the point here is that if you want to realize linear the E7, normally we have a non-linear realization of this E7 on these scalar fields. But if you want a linear realization, then you have to introduce E7 times U1 as a gauge invariance. And of course, you'd need that in order to not have, because this is a non-compact group, in order not to have ghosts and so on, you'd need to, it must be a gauge invariance. But the thing is, but the gauge fields are composite. So this is part of the structure of any well-known structure of N equals 8 supergravity. You need composite gauge fields for this E6 cross U1 gauge invariance. And a popular idea in the 1980s, the early 80s, was a suggestion that, well, because SO8 isn't good enough for, you know, isn't good enough to get the standard model out from, or grand unified model, the idea was that, well, maybe this SU8 is composite, but maybe with non-perturbative, et cetera, it will become dynamical. I think Kremer and Julia originally suggested it. And it actually was taken up and people tried to make some sense of it in the early 1980s. But it wasn't easy to get anything that was phenomenologically plausible, even if you just buy the, you know, even if you just accept as given the proposition that it will become dynamical gauge invariance. So on the other hand, you could see that in this context of getting these exceptional supergravity theories related to the exception algebras, it's a much better starting point for that program. So a further suggestion made in one of my papers with Moret and Herman Sierra was that you should take this program and apply it to these cases, because then you get as a dynamical gauge group, you get E6 cross U1, which at E6, you're already, you know, that's already a standard gut group. And also, there's an interesting point that this whole supergravity model actually contains another, this, so this exceptional supergravity actually contains a smaller supergravity model, which is still actually autonic. And it's related not directly to Jordan algebras, but to Jordan triple systems. And in fact, there are more possibilities once you go to four dimensions, and the real, really should think of things not in terms of Jordan algebras anymore, but in terms of these Jordan triple systems. But that's a whole lot more complicated. And so, in fact, I never really got to grips with the full thing there. So, but in that context, you have another model, which is contained in this one, which is actually E6 minus 14 over spin 10 plus U1. So whether you pick this one or whether you like that one, you're starting your process here with gut groups at least plausibly, phenomenologically much more plausible. Now that's purely speculative. It was not pursued. And if you look at the date, 1984, you can understand why it was not pursued. 1984, string revolution, everybody downed tools on whatever they were doing and started to do string theory. And also, of course, to some extent, string theory took away the motivation for a lot of these other things because, you know, okay, well, now that looks like it's a better bet for some unified theory, et cetera, et cetera. But in the end, it's not necessarily the case that they're completely disconnected. As I was saying before, it's quite possible that you could get some of these models simply by Calabi-Yau compactification or some more complicated compactifications. And so I think that's all I have to say, and I'll end there. Thanks very much. And I apologize again for my late start. At least I haven't gone over this time.
Thank you very much for the talk. Questions, please? Yes, later.
Can I just ask, could you clarify what you mean by composite gauge fields? Do you mean that they are bilinears in the fermions?
Well, I think it's a bit more than bilinear. They're nonlinear. I mean, yes, they're at least bilinear, shall we say. Yeah.
But built from fermion, built from spinner fields.
No.
Oh. Or maybe, oh, well, maybe you should say, yes, what do you?
Yeah. They're built. No, oh, wait a minute. No, they're built. No, they're not built from spinner fields. But yes, they may have spinner bilinears in as part of their definitions. Actually, probably they do, but I'm not sure about that. I'm not sure actually.
Maybe you should. Maybe instead of me trying to suggest it, you should say what you have something in mind when you say. Composite gauge fields, and I don't think I have the same thing in mind. Could you say what you mean by that?
Yeah, you construct them from basically derivatives. Well, I mean, essentially, it's from you've got, yeah. Yeah, you introduce some. Yeah, basically you have a lot, you've introduced a lot more scalars because you've got E7 minus 25 active linearly on them. And so, but it's essentially derivative. So, I mean, it's basically, you get a one form by taking derivative of scalar, and that has to be dressed, you know, in a nonlinear way. And potentially okay. In the context of the supergravity theory, the nonlinearities are going to involve fermion bilinears or quadrilinears and so on as well. But I mean, I think actually most of the time the people have looked at this. Well, I'm not sure, but you know, you can it's relatively easy to put the fermions to zero. But I'm not sure of the complete expressions. Probably they've been worked out, I think, in you know, DeWitt and Nicolai papers somewhere. But yeah, but essentially it's just, you know, derivatives of scalars. You've got more scalars now because you have E7 is acting linearly on them. So you have to introduce a whole lot more scalars and you have corresponding gauge invariances to get rid of them. Mm-hmm. So they're composite. In fact, the suggestion essentially is motivated by the fact, by the CPN models in two space dimensions. Because then you have, it's a similar thing, you have a CPN target space, then you can realize this the symmetry, it was SUN linearly. On scalar fields, but then what happens is you show that in the quantum theory, they become composite operators that get a pole, so they become dynamical in the quantum theory. So it actually works, and there are cases where that actually happens. But that's in two dimensions, and two dimensions is very special, of course. But there is a case. I was in fact looking at some of these papers just today. Actually, I was looking up some of the papers that were pursuing this suggestion. It was Ellis and Gaillard, Zimino, Gnaiding got into it, some other people as well. They list all of these previous cases as motivation. In fact, there's some three-dimensional quantum field theories, according to them. I didn't know that actually, but there's a three-dimensional where that also takes place in three dimensions. The point is you have to have the non-perturbative dynamics under you know, you have to have that under control before, because it's clearly some non-perturbative if it happens at all. And here that's field theory. Here we're talking about gravity. We don't have any kind of handle on the non-perturbative behavior, but maybe, you know, in the context of some string context, I mean, it's possible. I don't know. As I say, it really wasn't pursued. It was just dropped. And nobody's gone back to it for many, many years. But I think there are some things that perhaps could be looked at again there. I don't know how far one can get, but maybe somebody will have some reasonable ideas. But at least you could say, as a matter of principle, it's a way to try to connect guts through the guts to the exceptional Jordan algebras to N theory. And I don't think there are many other frameworks which could do that, even conjecturally. So right. I think that there's some things there that you know, would be worth pursuing.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions from anybody? Okay, Tijinder, go ahead. Yes.
Yeah.
Going back to the first part of your talk, could you say more about what is NAMBU mechanics? How is it different from ordinary classical mechanics?
Nambu mechanics is basically, the Poisson bracket is, you can view that as a kind of Jacobian, can't you? Your P with Q. You have basically, it's a P with Q with R, say, PQR. And then you have the, you have three variables, A, B, C. So what is the Nambu bracket of A, B, C? Well, A, B, and C are functions of this, let's take the very simplest case of, it's basically a phase space of three, dimension three. Mm-hmm. It's three sphere, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So call the parameters of that phase space, P, Q, and R.
Mm-hmm.
Think of it as momentum. P, Q, and R. Call it P, Q, and R. Mm-hmm. Then you have some kind of observables, functions on phase space, which is A, B, and C. Then you just take, it's a D, it's a Jacobian of D, A, B, C over D, P, Q, R. Totally asymmetrized.
What are called these metaplectic geometries as opposed to symplectic phase space geometries, where you have conserved three form.
That's right. So you would think that maybe it would be associated some kind of three form phase space, mm-hmm. but that's not the direction that Nambu goes in. It's a little while. I mean, I did actually have a brief look at his paper just today, but just to remind myself of what he did in the context of Jordan algebras.
Okay.
So that's what he does. But I think it's the examples that he gives. It's interesting that the examples that he gives, when he gives the example of a top, some kind of, it essentially involves angular momentum. Now, the thing is that if you think about, say, a rigid body or something rotating, some problem of that kind, you can have a phase space, which is, I'm not sure, but I think the point is that Jordan algebra seem to be connected to, in context of quantum mechanics, they seem to be connected to things which have a finite dimensional Hilbert space.
Finite dimensional
Hilbert space are connected with things like, you think of spin systems is the first thing. Anything connected with angular momentum. So I somehow think of it, so that's why it seems to me natural, given that you have Jordan, if you think of Jordan algebras potentially as the quantization of this Nambu bracket, then the Jordan algebras always seem to be finite dimensional phase spaces. So of course you can consider an infinite dimensional Jordan algebra, but somehow natural seems to be natural to finite dimension. Then that seems to indicate to me I should be systems of rotation, angular momentum. And indeed, the systems that, the examples that Nambu gives, they are all of this form. So that's kind of been explored a lot lately, but people have been trying to ask the question, how do you quantize the Nambu bracket?
Mm-hmm.
And I've spent some time on that myself. So I think that's in principle an important problem, but I think it's there's no consensus on what the answer is yet, because there's no kind of killer application that would say, yeah, well, obviously that's what you have to do. So I think we don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I'd love to know. It's related to actually some very interesting problems. It's related to how you understand all of these conformal field theories of multiple five brains, for example, multiple brains, multiple membranes.
Any connection with matrix models, which were once popular? I've seen similar structures there too. You haven't come across the string theory related matrix models. talking about.
Well, yes, yeah, I mean, that's right. Yes, actually, that's true. Because for example, if you take, you know, the matrix formulation of M theory, right? Mm-hmm. That can be actually, because there's multiple D zero brains. That I mean, what they use for that is essentially a membrane discretized, where essentially you take the Poisson bracket and you replace it by a commutator, and then you generate, that's essentially what it is. So if you start with the you know, the classical membrane, write down the action, and then you do it in you go to light cone gauge, you can essentially, what you get is this asymmetry of area preserving diffeomorphisms. And the point is that if you try to understand, well, how do you discretize an area preserving diffeomorphisms, as Jens Hoppe showed, you know, and Goldstone and Hoppe showed a long time ago, it's essentially SUN, and you take N to infinity. So N to infinity gives you basically a classical theory, which is area preserving diffeomorphisms. That's the classical membrane. So you can get a quantum membrane simply by taking SUN instead of area preserving diffeomorphisms. And that is essentially, and that gives you the matrix model of, you know, of M theory. So yes, precisely that step involves going from a basically quantizing a Poisson bracket, replacing a Poisson bracket by a commutator. And the thing is, if you tried to do the same thing, you said, well, instead of membranes, I think I'd like to do that for five brains, so three brains or something else. Then you'd need to do one of these Nambu brackets and quantize that.
Absolutely.
And if you could do that, then, well, you know, you probably make big progress on the various things related to M theory.
Right.
So that's why it's been widely, you know, there have been a lot of papers on this in recent years. But as I say, there's no consensus yet as to what. There's no consensus on that.
I wanted to make a comment.
Yeah.
It is interesting that the two algebras which are on the screen now, E7 minus 25, E6 minus 14, are the two real forms of E6, E7, which, like the conformal group, have discrete series and positive energy representations. The other real forms of E7 and E6 do not have.
Yeah, I suspect that that's no coincidence, because in fact there's a discussion of all those unitary representations. In fact, they came up. There's a paper by Murad Gunaydin and Zamino, I think, and some others, basically, and it has a whole section on unitary representations. In that case, it was. Well, I actually only looked at that relatively. I didn't even know about it. In fact, I was in contact with Murat Gunaydin, and he sent me a copy of it. I hadn't even known about it at the time. But actually, this kind of comment on this one appeared in my paper with Murat and Hermann Sierra. But I think it was definitely one that was inserted in the end of the, by Murat. I mean, neither Hermann nor I knew actually anything about this, but I think this appears in his paper. Or at any rate, there's some discussion. What you say reminds me of the discussion that he appears in his paper. His paper is from 1983, I think, or maybe 1984, but it's a paper with Zamino and it may be Gaillard Zamino. But they have, you know, Murat Gunaydin has a lot of, he's done a lot of stuff on this unitary representations and the non-compact algebras and so on. Yeah. So it's probably not a coincidence. Yes. But I don't know the details.
Thank you.
I would recommend, perhaps if you're interested, probably to look up. This shouldn't be too difficult to find, the paper.
Yeah. Around
that time of Murat Gunaydin and Bruno Zamino, at least two of the authors on it.
I have worked on these algebras myself.
Yeah,
This is, of course, the point which is interesting to me here is this relation to your stuff.
I shall
look at it.
May I ask one more question? Do we have time?
Yeah, sure.
If I understand correctly, the Nambu bracket is a kind of proposed generalization of the Poisson bracket and Hamiltonian mechanics. And in the normal Hamiltonian mechanics, I'm used to there being this kind of ordinarily a alternative Lagrangian formulation of things. Is the Nambu bracket also like that? Is there some kind of analog of the Lagrangian formalism for it? And relatedly, when you quantize, it's kind of related to the question of whether you expect some sort of path integral picture maybe start with the classical case. Are you aware of any kind of Lagrangian picture?
No, but let me say the following is that you should, I think first of all, you'd be asking really, is there any kind of Lagrangian formulation? Because I think it's essentially his mechanics is kind of a generalization of Hamiltonian. In fact, that's his starting point, because his starting point is essentially the fact that the theorem of the Liouville theorem about the phase space, the volume form of the phase space is preserved, right? Mm-hmm. In other words, he wants the time dependence to preserve the. So you have the Liouville theorem, the time dependence preserves the volume of phase space. And of course, that's really why, if you're thinking about things in terms of path integrals, it really makes much more sense to define path integrals in terms of integrals over phase space, because you have a natural measure, because dp, dq, right? That's, in some sense, there's a discrete size, that's h bar. And so you're really some, you can, you know, it's, you can, that means if you do it that way, you have an intuitive understanding that what you're doing is summing over cells of size, unit size, h bar in the whole phase space. And you don't have anything like that in the Lagrangian formulation. So the Lagrangian formulation is much less intuitive, I think, than the Hamiltonian formulation.
So you're saying maybe there could be a natural generalization of the path integral, but it would be kind of generalization of things,
That's right. And I think various other people came to that conclusion. For example, Fadeev and Popov. Initially, when they introduced Fadeev-Popov ghosts, it was in path integrals from a Lagrangian formulation. But that was all reformulated later in the Hamiltonian formulation. And, I think Fadeev says in his papers, it's all much simpler and much nicer in the Hamiltonian formulation. Hamiltonian formulation is the more fundamental. That's what Dirac says. I'm a convert to that years ago. Mm-hmm. But Nambu was basically, he took as his starting point, he wanted a phase space of dimension three, say, where the time dependence, well, at least at any rate, there was a Liouville theorem, a kind of Liouville theorem, that the volume would be preserved. So that's essentially the starting point of his paper.
Mm-hmm. Great, thank you.
Any other questions? Well, maybe I can ask a quick question. So I think I understood how E7 in this homogeneous group space that you have on top of the slide, E7, I think I understand how E7 appears. Can you explain how E6 appears in the denominator? Is it just because
E6? It must be the maximally compact subgroup. So, in some sense, you're asking me why minus 25? There's an equivalent question, why this particular non-compact form? Because whatever the form is, you have to divide it by its maximally compact subgroup. Because otherwise you'd have ghosts. In order to get a symmetry group, with a non-compact symmetry group, that's a necessary step. But so essentially, why this particular non-compact form? There's these natural sets of groups, automorphism structure and Möbius group, which in some sense are like analogs of rotation. This group acts as acts on this space here by linear fractional transformations. So if you think about in the usual situation of conformal group acting by linear fractional transformations, then that's how this is acting here. I mean, it just comes out to be this particular group with that particular non-compact form. If you ask me why, I mean, I wouldn't know really. Except that, no, I don't know. I mean,
And what about the E6 minus 14?
Oh, well, E6. That one, you know, yeah, I know that I really don't know. I mean, why that comes up. I mean, I'd completely forgotten about this, actually, until I went back looking at my own paper with Hermet-Sierre, and I noticed at the end we had this bit in, which I think obviously had been put in by Murat Genaydin, and obviously with our agreement at the time, but we didn't certainly know anything about that. But I don't know. Presumably you could derive all of the n equals, all of the four-dimensional supergravity theories, or at least a large number of them with these kind of spaces, just by interpreting everything in terms of these Jordan triple systems. And there is a subsequent, my collaborator at the time, Hermet-Sierre, I think he did pursue that a little bit in terms of Jordan triple systems. But I'm not sure. I mean, I didn't pursue it myself. I mean, as I say, this was the time when after we'd done this stuff, string theory came along. So it was a case of moving on to something else. So I don't know the answer to that one. But except, of course, it does, you know, I mean, it comes out. These are just the ones that come out of these constructions. So I'm sure it would, you know, there are other properties that will be, maybe there's some nice property that you could kind of give an intuitive argument as to why you need that property, therefore you have to have this particular non-compact form. But I'm sure there must be some statement along those lines, but I don't know what it is.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Hey, are there any more questions? If not, let's thank Paul again.
Thank you.